Hey, welcome back to Politico Tech. Today's Tuesday, April 16th. I'm Stephen Overly. Late last week, we talked about a controversial government surveillance law that's soon set to expire, and all of the political maneuvering in the House to get it reauthorized, which happened on Friday. Well, this week, the future of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act gets kicked over to the Senate. Now, behind the scenes, the Biden administration has been pressing both chambers to extend the program, which allows intelligence agencies to spy on foreign nationals overseas without obtaining warrants. And specifically, the White House wants to extend the program without adding new rules that would require a warrant for handling information collected about Americans in the process. Joshua Geltzer is a deputy White House counsel and legal advisor on the National Security Council. And that makes him one of Biden's top defenders of this surveillance law, commonly referred to as FISA. On the show today, Joshua defends the program against its critics and argues the recent attack Iran launched on Israel illustrates why it's needed. Well, Josh, appreciate you joining us on Politico Tech.
Thanks so much for the chance to join you.
Now, we were supposed to talk on Friday, and then FISA issues basically exploded back to life on Capitol Hill. Late last week, the House did vote to reauthorize the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It now heads to the Senate, where the breakdown of sort of the support and opposition feels a little less predictable in some ways. What conversations is the White House having with lawmakers over there this week?
So big picture, there are some themes that we've been hitting for over a year now. How essential the authority is, what an opportunity this reauthorization represents to enhance the guardrails, even as we maintain the value. But I think there's one message in particular, which is to actually make sure that senators and their staff engage with the text. Because some of what was frustrating about the debate on the House side last week were some distortions. Now, one of the distortions was with respect to an amendment that did not succeed, that got referred to often as a warrant requirement, but was not actually a warrant requirement. It was actually just a straight-up prohibition on access to lawfully held information with some very narrow and unworkable exceptions. And so the amendments that did make it, I want to make sure that those on the Senate side dig in and see what they really stand for and what they don't stand for. Overall, we hope this will move through the Senate swiftly, because we're coming up close to the expiration date of the current statute.
And so I guess with the way that all of the votes and the amendments broke down in the House, does the White House support the Senate passing the House bill in its current form?
We do. It's a hard bill to implement. We should be candid about that. Even the base bill that got offered in the House before amendments were added contained a number of steps that we would not have volunteered, steps with regard to oversight and transparency and auditing and reporting that will be very challenging to implement. That said, it ultimately maintains an authority that we regard as essential, not for ourselves, but for our responsibility to protect the country and its people. And we do think the new requirements, new reforms, some of which we supported, some of which came at us, are livable, are manageable.
And so, the main sticking point in the House involved lawmakers essentially wanting to require that the government obtain a warrant before accessing the data and information of U.S. citizens. The White House called that a red line and, just as you said, sort of saw that as going beyond just a warrant requirement to kind of an all-out ban. What is your response, though, to people who say that the federal government has used this program to unlawfully spy on American citizens?
So there have been compliance errors with respect to querying, with respect to organizing this information once lawfully collected. But that should be separated from the notion that somehow this is being used to actually target Americans, which is straight up banned by the statute and not the source of those compliance errors in the past. The statute is very clear. You cannot target for collection Americans or anyone on American soil, and you can't even target non-Americans abroad if your real goal is to see the Americans with whom they are in touch. Now, that has been administered with great consistency across the program. There have been compliance errors about how to organize already lawfully collected information, these queries in which the rules approved by the FISA court for when we organize that information around the Americans who are being talked about by non-Americans abroad or even talked to by non-Americans abroad are used. Now, for that, we do think it's important to tighten up, and we have tightened up. In 2021, a number of reforms were introduced that dropped the number of those queries by 93% and that have led to an improved compliance rate. In the last quarter of 2023, that compliance rate was over 99%. This law, the version that goes to the Senate, will take all those things and make them not just policy, but actual statutory requirements, plus add more. So we think this is a win-win. It maintains a valuable collection authority, and it augments what we've already done as an executive branch to deal with some of those compliance errors of the past.
You know, we interviewed Elizabeth Goitein, who's a privacy advocate at NYU's Brennan Center for Justice, on the podcast just last week, who made the argument that lawmakers, some political dissidents, have had their information swept up in these FISA 702 searches. And so I do think that there is a sense that it is being used to target, or certainly that information that is being gathered is being used by the government to look at and look into the activity of American citizens.
So look, this is where I think it's important to disentangle fact from fiction. It is true that the only permissible targets of this collection, non-Americans abroad, sometimes will talk about Americans. They talk about Americans they're trying to kill. They talk about Americans they're trying to recruit as spies. They talk about American companies they're trying to hack. That's something that we obviously can't prevent them talking about that. But we do want to know about it when it's happening. Why? So we can save the lives of those assassination targets. So we can help those companies avoid being hacked. So we can warn an American that what they think is a legitimate researcher they're talking about is actually a spy recruiter for a hostile foreign power. And then going one step further, sometimes those non-Americans abroad who are the only lawful targets of 702 collection might be in touch with Americans. This is something that was known when 702 was created. Indeed, it was considered sometimes the most important thing to be aware of, because those non-Americans abroad might be recruiting someone here as a terrorist operative, as a spy, to help with proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And so what 702 offers is only what the non-American abroad has among their communications. If there's reason to be concerned about the Americans they're talking to or talking about, then other appropriate tools need to be used. Maybe that's warning an American that they're a potential victim. Maybe it's using traditional law enforcement tools, including obtaining a warrant to investigate an American. But at that point, a pivot needs to be made to other appropriate tools for further investigation.
You know, the amendment that would have put those provisions in place failed on a tie vote, which is pretty rare on the Hill. It doesn't really get any closer than that when it comes to action on the Hill. And so in order to kind of get this bill over the Hill, so to speak, you know, House Speaker Mike Johnson had to change the sunset date. This program now expires in 2 years instead of five. I'm curious if you think that your allies on the Hill can win this battle again in 2026, especially, you know, we're facing an election. There is a scenario in which former President Donald Trump is back in the White House at that time.
Look, we do think 2 years is an unfortunately small amount of time for this sunset, recognizing that that's where the bill now stands and that we support it overall because it's too important to maintain this authority rather than let it lapse. But the question of whether this continues to yield value, I think, can be won each time. Whatever one cares about right now with respect to a very challenging national security and foreign policy environment, Section 702 collection is essential. It has helped us uncover Russian war crimes in Ukraine. It helped us identify and take off the battlefield the global head of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri. It has helped us recover, for example, the ransomware paid in the Colonial Pipeline ransomware incident. So whether you care about stopping fentanyl from coming to the United States or protecting our critical infrastructure or understanding what hostile actors like the Russians are doing in the world, this is a key source. And there's no kind of confusion as to why. Bad actors around the world use U.S. technologies to communicate. There should be a statutory framework, as there has been now for almost two decades, for working with U.S. companies to obtain these communications of non-Americans abroad. And this statutory framework is a pretty good way to go about it.
Hey, I mean, Trump did message his supporters last week on the Hill telling them to, quote, kill FISA. So if he's president again, do you worry what will happen to this program?
Look, when Donald Trump was sitting in the Oval Office as president, he signed into law the last reauthorization of 702. Indeed, he issued a statement the day he did so and said he had only one regret, which was that there was a sunset, at that point, a five-year sunset to the provision, rather than making permanent an authority so essential to protecting Americans that it should not ever lapse. Now, it seems that those who sit in the actual chair of the executive branch of needing to protect Americans and needing to obtain the communications of non-Americans abroad to yield insights to doing so have been pretty consistent across parties at the need to have this sort of authority.
So it sounds like you see this as a little bit of candidate blustering as opposed to, you know, a president who has to actually wave the pen, so to speak.
Look, I can't speak for Donald Trump or I can't speak for Donald Trump as a candidate. All I can do is look to history and say that when he had the responsibility as president to protecting Americans, he wanted this authority. Indeed, he wanted it to remain permanent.
I wonder, you know, as a tech reporter who's been covering kind of the broader privacy conversation in the country, data and online privacy has become far more mainstream than it used to be. This is something that people are concerned about more generally, even beyond just this specific FISA program. With the fact that this amendment failed on a tie vote, there is this greater consciousness about data privacy and people wanting to protect that in general. Does that suggest that, you know, the way trend lines are going, at some point this program is going to need more substantive reforms?
I think reforms already have been needed, and part of what this reauthorization cycle has offered the opportunity to do is take the reforms that we have chosen to do. We as an executive branch have, on our own initiative, put in place those really powerful reforms I mentioned before, and this reauthorization cycle offers the chance to make them law. Let me just give you one really concrete sense of a reform, and it's kind of simplistic, but I think it may help listeners understand why it has had the dramatic impact that it has. It used to be that if an FBI agent or an FBI analyst was running a query, was looking at information already in the holdings of FBI based on a query term, a search term, that agent or that analyst needed to remember to click something to opt out of the particular information that had been gathered under Section 702 if that agent or analyst wasn't supposed to be or otherwise didn't want to include that information in his or her search. They needed to opt out, and they often forgot. And that contributed to a number of U.S. person queries that should not have been run. They weren't even intended to be run. Now, that is simply bad system design. And indeed, there was a system overhaul a few years ago that led to what I mentioned before. In 2021, a number of reforms being implemented, one of which is now an opt-in system. So now, if you're at FBI field office, you're sitting at FBI headquarters, you need, if you want to query 702 information, to opt in and click something. And then a pop-up comes on your screen and says, well, why do you think you're entitled to query 702 information in particular? Which category of FISA court-approved query is the one you're trying to run in? And once you choose that, another pop-up comes on your screen and says, okay, in your own words, explain, based on the facts of your investigation, why you think you fit into that category. And that explanation gets saved so it can be audited later. And only then is there actually access granted to any 702 information responsive to the query. Now that's, you know, it's not kind of complex or esoteric thoughts on the privacy security balance. It's a very concrete system overhaul that has dramatically improved the privacy considerations at stake in this program. And that's the sort of thing we believe wholeheartedly.
And I guess one last question on this, you know, and that's, are there enough checks on that process and that system? I mean, in reality, a lot of it takes place in an opaque way because it involves national security and intelligence. I mean, the American people don't have great insight into all the government structures around this information and the protections on it. How can people trust that these processes are actually being followed?
So the compliance errors of the past, which we're not proud of, indeed, we've worked hard to correct, those have come to light precisely because of the executive branch's own oversight. So it's hard, I think, for critics of this to have it both ways. On the one hand, they seem to trust a whole lot what oversight revealed in the past. when they want to criticize the program, but then they don't seem to trust oversight as a way to keep providing a sense of how the program's working. I don't think you can have it both ways. That oversight has been meaningful. It doesn't just live within the executive branch. It gets presented to the FISA court, as well as to four committees of Congress. And it will become even more meaningful if the Senate passes the version of the 702 reauthorization bill that the House sent over, one requirement of which is 100% audits of FBI's U.S. person queries going forward.
I have to ask before we sign off here, you know, the geopolitical backdrop behind all of this shifted pretty dramatically over the weekend when Iran launched an attack on Israel. There are now concerns about a broader war in the Middle East. I wonder, how are you specifically seeing the U.S. response to that? And as a tech podcast, I'm wondering if there's a role for tech to play in deterring this from becoming an all-out conflict.
Look, there was pretty remarkable technology deployed by the United States and by other partners just over the weekend in the wholly defensive actions taken to address the really unprecedented and appalling attack unleashed by Iran. You know, pretty remarkable to be able to take out so much of that incoming in real time. So I think technology suffuses all of these conversations. And frankly, there's a connection between this issue and the 702 one we've just been talking about, which is it is a challenging world out there. And there's a world in which bad actors, just like good actors, are finding new ways to try to communicate and coordinate. And at that moment, it seems like the wrong time to reduce our insights into that. Because however good our technology may be, and it's often quite good, we do need to understand what bad actors are doing, especially with respect to threats to Americans in the United States. And so I think it's here that we need to continue to figure out how we maintain insight, how we have that baseline understanding that then enables the next set of options. What do we do to actually protect Americans? And that's where collection authorities like 702 come into the picture.
Well, Josh, appreciate you making time for us here at Politico Tech.
Thank you so much for the chance for the conversation. I'm grateful.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. I'll see you back here tomorrow.